Hello, and welcome to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. John Porcerelli, a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy, a practicing psychoanalyst, and a researcher of defenses. So, I'm here with my co-host, Madeline Paxson, and...
Madeline, okay, Xenon.
What?
I mean, I'm sure it's a totally normal, good friend thing to do to mispronounce your friend of 8 months' first name.
Oh.
It's totally normal.
Oh, yeah, sure. Totally. It's just as common of a thing as not being able to let one little mistake go after a long friendship, Madeline.
I just think it's funny, Zenon.
Even funnier that this is how we're starting off our talk about defense mechanisms.
I would low-key be pissed if you thought my name was like Madeline or Madison or something.
As I would if you were to call me Xenon.
Yeah, which I did call you Xenon for about the first 3 months of knowing you, I'm pretty sure.
In all fairness, a lot of people do that after knowing me even longer.
Yeah.
So.
Zenon like Lennon with a Z. So the first defense mechanism that we are going to talk about today is one that I am very well versed in.
As am I.
Yes. And that's passive aggression.
Yep. It's an indirect expression of contempt to kind of avoid direct confrontation while still getting in a jab at someone.
Yeah. You know what you did.
Yeah.
So you can use sarcasm to be passive aggressive. Kind of maybe backhanded compliments, like, I love how you just don't care what people think. Like, that's kind of a passive-aggressive statement.
Exactly.
So we can see this phrase that we use pretty often, and I feel in our day-to-day lives, at work in psychological defense mechanisms.
Yeah, and it turns out that passive aggression is at the second lowest functioning level of psychological defenses.
Yeah, so there's, like, kind of a scale, I guess,
yeah.
A different classification of how some phraseology is like immature versus mature, primitive versus
sophisticated.
Yeah. So basically,
unhealthy versus healthy, yeah, maladaptive versus adaptive.
Yeah. They're pretty
interesting. It's kind of like bad to good.
Yeah, a bad to good scale. That simplifies
yeah.
it. And passive aggression is actually one of the lowest on that scale for badness.
Yeah, there's like 7 categories. And the very lowest category includes psychosis, which is a fancy word for hallucinations, and delusions, which is believing a fact that cannot possibly be true. Like, I am the President of the United States. That would be a delusion, because I'm not the President of the United States. And that is at the very lowest level of defensive functioning. The next level up is passive aggression and help rejecting complaining. So, let's say that Maddie ordered a pizza with olives on it, of all
things. I'm despicable.
And I were to say, oh god, these olives that he put in this pizza are so awful.
Oh, I'll pick them off for you.
No, it's, this pizza is completely ruined, I could never accept that help. That's an example of help rejecting complaining. But, Maddie, what kinds of things might cause us to employ defense mechanisms?
Well, Zenon, like, pretty much things that cause emotional stress. So things like maybe conflict between you and another person or an accusation might cause you to be defensive, trying to protect your image of yourself, how you see yourself. It could be some bad news that might come with feelings you don't want to deal with, like if a loved one passed away, you might not want to deal with all the emotional stress that that comes with, so you pull out one of your handy-dandy defense mechanisms out of your toolbox.
Yeah, so really anything then that causes negative emotions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like seeing olives on a pizza,
yeah.
Or having your name mispronounced, or yeah. Anything
yeah, to like that's... having your great-aunt Ruth's
die.
Cat die.
Yeah.
Tragic.
Gotcha. The cat died, yeah.
Sprinkles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, poor Sprinkles.
In a way, it might sound like we're, by classifying it as a defense mechanism, like, oh, something that's kind of dumbing it down. But really, like, at its core, that's its function is to protect your consciousness from those things that are just so impossible to process because
yeah.
of the amount of stress that they might bring.
Yeah. It, like, protects your core personality, what makes you,
yes,
from these other things that would otherwise damage yourself.
Yeah. And that's the same kind of function that we see with all of these. Like, our next one, denial.
Denial? I never use denial, Maddie. I would never be caught dead using denial as a defense mechanism.
Precisely. enough said on that one, I think, honestly.
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah.
Denial is pretty straight up.
Yeah.
Tommy, did you steal that cookie? Well, I didn't steal that cookie, as you watch cookie crumbs dripping from his mouth.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely was one of the more immature,
yeah,
defense mechanisms, just because, like you said, we do see it a lot in children.
yep.
And other,
it's, again, people, a couple levels up from DID, but still not healthy.
Yeah. So another defense mechanism that we talk about a lot is repression. And this is what occurs when you have an impulse that maybe isn't the most socially acceptable, so you act in the opposite way. So one example of this might be if you work in a daycare or something, and you hate kids. You would be happy to just, like, punt them across the kickball field. And instead, your defense mechanism to this, so that you can maintain your self-image of being a warm, loving person, is to be, oh my gosh, I love these little dudes. That is not based on personal experience, by the way. I did work with kids this summer, but I do love those little dudes.
Yep, and just a bit of a PSA here. While repression may not be the healthiest defense mechanism, if it keeps you from punting kids across a football field, I encourage you to practice it.
Yeah, maybe it's adaptive in that,
yeah,
form.
Exactly, yep. Which just shows how helpful defense mechanisms can be. Because, yeah, without defense mechanisms, we would just have people punting kids across football fields left and right.
Oh, hold on one second. I'm getting a phone call.
Okay.
Oh my god, Zenon.
No.
Your goldfish died.
No, Maddie, it can't be.
Yeah. It's...
Oh. I mean, when you think about it, goldfish don't live very long, so... I should be able to accept the time I've had with my goldfish. Because really, when it comes down to the facts of the matter, like... He lived longer than average, right?
Well, Zenon, it sounds like to me like you're intellectualizing this situation so that you don't have to deal with the pain of having lost your goldfish. Oh, I know, I'm sorry, Zenon, but it's true. You're focusing on the facts of the situation, which is what we call intellectualization.
Yep. And repression and intellectualization are both on the level right below perfectly healthy.
Yes. So it's like, okay.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's not optimal, but it's a lot better than, like, psychosis.
Yeah.
Or DID. But yeah. So these next five we're going to talk about are awesome and healthy, and we encourage you to use these in whatever conflicts, tragedies, other emotional stressors,
yeah,
may occur in your life. So the first of these is suppression. And that might occur where, let's say, I get this phone call that my goldfish has died. And I'm right in the middle of recording a podcast. So what do I do? For now, I suppress that so that I can continue functioning. And then later in the day, or maybe tomorrow, if necessary, I will deal with the emotional trauma of having lost my goldfish.
Yes. So this is not to be confused with repression. Right.
Yeah, repression is like the beating down.
Yeah, we're just going to keep that down forever.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like the beating down of an unacceptable impulse.
Yeah.
Like, you want to eat French fries? No carbs for you.
Yeah.
These things.
So with repression, it's like, okay, we're just going to tuck that away in my pocket and take it out when I have the time and the space to really process it.
Exactly. And on that note, a big thank you to the University of Michigan Dearborn Supplemental Instruction Program for the French fries they supplied us with for this episode. Cheers to you if you're listening.
Yeah.
So what other healthy defense mechanisms do we have access to, Maddie?
Well, this one is one of my very favorites. It's called sublimation. And basically, it's like finding an outlet for these emotions that you're experiencing. So like for me, I have lots of creative outlets that I use. If I had my friend's goldfish die and I'm in mourning, I might use those feelings to create a beautiful painting of that fish for my friend Zenon, or to maybe I would write what is it called, a dirge or something for the goldfish's funeral, like a way to express my feelings in a productive way rather than a destructive way. It's for other people that might look like sports, boxing, things like that. And if you have a little bit of both, like a little bit of physical, a little bit of artistic expression, like that is such a special thing.
That is a truly beautiful defense mechanism, Maddie.
Yes.
Although, you know you're a true psychology nerd when you have a favorite defense mechanism. I mean, am I right? And that right there, see, as evidenced by Maddie's laughter, that right there is an example of the defense mechanism of humor.
Yeah. Yeah, you ever notice how, like, every comedian, it seems, has some, like, messed up backstory or something? Like, you just can't help but wonder what their primary defense mechanisms are. But, yeah, so the next one is humor. And I can totally see how that would be adaptive. You don't take yourself too seriously. You're able to funnel these feelings, express them, but in a really socially acceptable way.
Yeah. So, like, instead of just, like, brooding over how much of a psychology nerd I am, I make a joke. Ah! How funny it is. Psychology nerds we are. So, yeah.
The next one is another good one.
It's a very good one.
Yeah. And that is altruism.
Aww. Yep. Might even be my favorite defense mechanism.
Aww.
Because with altruism, the whole idea is, oh, my goldfish died. I feel bad. Like, what can I do?
Gonna start a foundation to...
Exactly. Yeah. Or like, you know, my goldfish died and that makes me sad. But you know what? Not all people need to be sad, so I'm gonna go to a soup kitchen and help people be happy by serving them food.
That's right. Or open up a hospital just for goldfishes.
Totally. Or like, I'm going to make a nice dinner for my family so everyone can enjoy time together and everything.
The very last one, which I think is also very cool, is affiliation. Affiliation, well, it's like confiding in another person, being seen, being heard. I'm getting emotional.
Yeah, turn.
Having friends or a therapist or your family to confide in, to talk to about the things that you're experiencing emotionally. It's an excellent way to express that.
Definitely. Turning to other people for help or support, as the DSM-4 puts it so romantically.
Absolutely.
Yep. Although it also adds a caveat. This is when you reach out to someone else for support, this is not when you try to blame your problems on someone else. It's also a social way of dealing with problems, but that is not a healthy way of dealing with problems.
Right.
So, healthy social affiliation involves just, you know, reaching out for a supportive ear.
Yes. I had that happen like 3 times today. Like, for example, we get into the lab, I'm like, oh, sending my feet stink. He says, that's okay, Maddie. Mine do too. I'm like, wow, thank you for affiliating with me. I feel so much better. That's a little rundown of some of the major defense mechanisms. There's actually way, way more if you're interested in looking into that more. We'll have links in the show notes.
Yeah, there's going to be this nice 7-page PDF straight out of the DSM-4 with descriptions and classifications for all of you psychology nerdy hearts to devour.
But in the meantime, there's actually much, much more to learn about defense mechanisms in our conversation with Dr. Porcerelli.
So we're here with Dr. Porcerelli of the University of Detroit Mercy. Dr. Porcerelli, can you briefly describe your background in education for us?
Okay. I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and did my master's and doctoral degree at the University of Detroit before it was University of Detroit Mercy. After graduating, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I know I wanted to get training in both child and adult psychology. So I took on a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship at the School of Medicine at Wayne State University. Their Department of Psychiatry offered a 1 year of child training, both inpatient work, inpatient psychiatric hospital work, and outpatient therapy. And the following year was a year of adult inpatient psychiatry and outpatient psychiatry. Then when I graduated, I was interested in psychodynamic theories and research. And so I decided to join the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, which was an additional 5 years of training.
Oh, wow.
And that was during years in private practice and as an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the med school at Wayne. Near the midpoint of my psychoanalytic training, I took a job as a health psychologist for the Department of Family Medicine at Wayne State University. So in the evening, I was doing my long-term psychoanalytic therapy. During the day, I was doing consults for physicians, primary care physicians, internal medicine physicians, on the inpatient service at Sinai Grace Hospital, and eventually at Crittenden Hospital in Rochester, teaching family medicine residents about behavioral science and about psychiatric issues related to their medical patients. So that's how things kind of got started. And then when you talk about education, you know, one of the nice things about being a psychologist is that it's ongoing. It's lifelong education. I mean, always reading, always writing, doing research. You know, part of the reason why I took an academic position is because I missed doing research. And I was in private practice, and which I liked, but 12 hours sitting in your office and thinking about research projects and getting journals and finding things interesting, I just thought, wait a minute, I gotta do both.
Yeah, I gotta get back in the action.
So
yeah.
So that's what I did.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what first drew you to psychology as an undergraduate?
What drew me to psychology as an undergraduate? It's a long story, but I'll make it pithy. When I graduated from a terrible high school student, and all I ever wanted to be was like a boxing champion. So I fought for the Detroit Kronk boxing team.
Oh, cool.
For a few years, and I got an offer to go to Boston, Massachusetts, actually Brockton, Massachusetts, a mm-hmm. old shoe factory town in Massachusetts, and to train with the manager and the trainer for the world middleweight champion.
Wow.
So it just so happened that his son lived in Brownstown, and he came up to visit him, and he came up to see the Golden Glove championships and saw me fight and said, you should come to Boston because you're Italian. There's a lot of Italians in Boston, and that would be better for you, because in Detroit, you know, they're going to promote the African-American fighters probably more so than the white fighters, because that's what their audience is going to be mainly. And I thought, well, wow, okay. So I went to Boston and I fought, and after 6 months I got a serious concussion, and I had to quit. Well, it just so happened that when I was in Boston, in Brockton actually, in the gym, there was a guy who would be there every day, would watch the fighters, got to know all of the fighters, quiet guy, nice guy, and everybody seemed to know him. And he was a neuropsychologist. Makes sense. His research interest was, guess,
concussions?
Head injury, yeah.
He's in the right place.
He was in the right place. And he was a professor at Bridgewater State University. I happen to live in Bridgewater, right next to Brockton. And so I got to know him. And he said, why don't you, you know, you're just in the apartment complex right across from the college. Why don't you just come over to my classes? It was very nice. I went to the classes. He'd introduce me as this is one of the Petronelli brothers. He was one of their boxers, is Porcerelli. And he's in the Petronelli boxing stable. And he's here to watch. People were very nice. But I watched the slideshow. And it's about brains that got messed up through constant pummeling, through boxing, through rugby, through football.
Yeah.
And so I thought, wow, this is really fascinating. And so I went through a whole darn semester with him. I couldn't wait to the next class. I thought this was the coolest thing. And people were very nice to me. I thought, this is great. You know, I didn't know a lot of people in Bridgewater. I'm by myself. Actually, I was with a couple of other fighters, but I didn't like hanging out with them too much. They were even crazier than I was. And so when I got back home and I thought, what on earth am I going to do? Because my whole youth was originally karate, training in karate, and training in boxing. And I thought maybe, you know, a health club, maybe I'll open a health club. But you got to have money to open a health club. Mm-hmm. So I got to get a, you know. So I was working two jobs. I thought, you know, maybe I should try school. And I started to take some community college classes. And a friend of mine was running with a professor at U of M Dearborn at the time. Oh. He's no longer there. It's Jeffrey Stern. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Stern was a neuropsychologist. He was actually a runner at Cal Berkeley when he was in college.
Oh.
So I got to know him, and he said, you know, you should come on over to U of M Dearborn. I said, I'm just starting out, man. I'm just taking, you know, I had to take intermediate algebra. I had to take non-credit courses at a community college to mix in with some of the other, just to get the basics to take regular. That's how bad of a high school student I was.
Right, you're starting over.
Yeah. So I said, okay. He said, I get you in as a special student. You'll be a special student. Just come here next semester. Okay. So I started going to U of M Dearborn, and I started working my tail off and studying. I became, you know, the head of Rick Straub's lab, me and another student. The other student went on to be a podiatrist. Yeah, I thought that was kind of weird.
Yeah,
he wanted to be a psychologist, but he went and, he
went to the other
chose podiatry.
Goal. Yeah.
yeah, he went to the dark side or something. So, And things took off from there. I remember, you know, there's so many instrumental people. There was a sociologist named Jim Gruber. And Dr. Gruber is very sick right now, unfortunately. But he was the first professor to say, you know, kid, you ought to think about graduate school. This paper is really interesting. I remember the paper. It was on sex role stereotypes in advertising.
It's very interesting.
I don't know why. I can't remember what I ate lunch, you know, with my lunch yesterday, but I remember the paper. And he said, you know, graduate. And, you know, those folks were like incredibly supportive, really just incredibly supportive there. And I started thinking, man, I can do this.
Yeah.
That's how it. And I originally wanted to be a neuropsychologist. But then it was sort of like health psychology because I was working with Rick Straub.
Yeah.
And Rick Straub, his studies were dominance tube studies of rats. Rats on each end, they would run to the middle, and whichever one pushed the other one past the line was the dominant one. And then we had a group of dominant and non-dominant rats. And we did an animal model for coronary prone behavior, type A behavior. So I thought, that's interesting. So I had all these things floating around in my head. I went to the University of Detroit, and that was very psychodynamic.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, at the University of Detroit, they start you doing clinical work, and they get you with a supervisor in the community, and I got teamed up with this guy named David Dietrich, Dr. Dietrich, who was a darn good researcher and a psychoanalyst. I thought, I wasn't crazy about Freud in undergrad, but as I started seeing patients, it started making sense that, you know, a lot of these concepts were interesting, like defense mechanisms and attachment and therapeutic alliance and unconscious processing. People who would come in and say, I know this is bad for me to do, but I keep doing it. Mm-hmm. The same thing happens over and over again. So you can talk about all the conscious motivations in the world. You're not going to touch it. You need a methodology to get to whatever it is that the person's struggling with. And that's a whole different method. Then you talk about Sigmund Freud and free association. Well, it's not all, free association like the old days. You lay on a couch and just say what comes to mind. But you let people talk. You let them organize what they're talking about. I don't dictate what they talk about. And through their just natural flow of thoughts and feelings, you learn the method of extracting unconscious communications. And I thought, wow, well, that's interesting too. That's how the brain, that's brain too. That's neuropsychology. So I was sort of mixed up in grad school, but eventually I did a combination of my research interest and psychoanalytic interest for my dissertation, which was a construct validity study of a projective test. So I did a scientific evaluation of a projective test, and it turned out well, and we published it, and it was okay. But so it led me to the things that I, you know, the psychoanalytic training, although I'm not, I don't identify myself as a psychoanalyst. That's not what you see my couch. I can do psychoanalysis. I always have a couple of patients doing more of the intensive therapy, but from my health psychology background, I can do cognitive behavioral therapy. I can do exposure therapy for post-traumatic stress. I do a lot of psychodynamic psychotherapy. You know, a lot of my patients come once or twice a week. But there are some that are in it for really a long period of time and very detailed treatment. So
Yeah, everything kind of clicks when you find something that you really can dig into, for sure. We've heard that from a couple interviews is that high school, you know, wasn't really their thing, but then they started studying psychology, and then like that fire was ignited, and then you just can't get enough knowledge and learning, and just absolutely, you catch a bug for it.
Well, that's the romantic view. My view is maybe my frontal lobes just didn't develop. And when they did, it all clicked in. becoming an impulsive menace.
So prior to us meeting today, you mentioned that you were excited about psychological defenses. So we thought we'd talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
What are psychological defenses?
Psychological defenses. Well, defenses are mechanisms that our minds use automatically to manage anxiety and distress. So there's various ways we can manage anxiety and distress. We can call a friend and talk to a friend, right? That's a pretty good coping mechanism. We can develop like conscious strategies, like if I get too anxious, if I think about what am I really anxious about, is it realistic? Is it very helpful to worry about that when I don't have any control over it? You kind of put it in perspective. But then there's these things that happen that we're not even aware of that they're happening, that lessen our anxiety. It's sort of this automatic mechanism that we've developed, you know, as the species has developed, as a way to manage and keep an equilibrium of our central nervous system, of the arousal, the sympathetic nervous system. And that's what gets me very excited. It's like, where do they come from? How do we know? You know, they're probably connected to personality to a certain degree. You know, personality is about 50% genetic. So the defense mechanisms run in families,
Right.
So I started to study it and started to see how people would study this defense mechanism and that defense mechanism. And, oh, if you had that defense mechanism, that's a bad sign. That means you have a severe personality problem, or if you use this. And then I started to read about, there's a man named George Valent. And George Valent, it was like, I don't know if you've ever had experience where you're, you read a book and you say, oh my God, listen to the way this person's describing this experience or this thing. And it just captured my, I mean, I thought, oh my God, this is what I want to look, I want to study this. And it was his notion of, you know, people have many, many defense mechanisms. And some are very healthy and mature. And if you use them, it brings about a lot of good stuff in your life, including physical health. It's actually related to physical health. Longitudinal studies have shown that, healthy defense mechanisms are good for our health. Then there's another set of them, about 10 or so, of neurotic defense mechanisms. What's neurotic? Well, the normal neurotic, well, we're all neurotic. If we're fairly healthy, we all have our little weird
worries.
Especially me. Underneath that is another set of defenses that are a little bit more what we call the narcissistic defenses, the minor image distorting defenses. So we put people down to feel better. We act really special when none of us are all that special, right? But so there's those underneath that kind of blot out reality, like denial. Like, no, I'm not a mean person. No, I didn't forget about our meeting today, right? And when adults use those kinds of defenses, they look silly. Everybody can see them. They don't see them as clearly as everybody else does. You'd think, what the, right?
Yeah.
Like if I said, well, it's your fault for not calling me and reminding me of this meeting. That would be projection. Those are immature. Those like, and you don't make friends with them. Well, there's even those that are even less mature. And so it's not so much, do you have a bad defense? Do you have any of those immature defenses? We all have them. But it's the issue is, what's the relative use of them? If I usually use healthy defenses, if I have a great sense of humor, and I'm keeping you laughing, and every once in a while I become a pain in the ass and accuse you of things that really are my problems, you might forgive me because I'm using a lot of healthy defenses, and in some, I'm an okay guy to hang out with, right? But it's really the balance of these defenses. And unfortunately, in American psychiatry, defense mechanisms were slated as going into the diagnostic system. The original system, I don't know if you guys know about the DSM-IV,
No.
It's what we call a multi-axial system. So if somebody comes into your office or into the hospital, so you have to do an assessment. It says you must assess their symptoms to see if they have a syndrome or disorder, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, something. The second level is that you have to assess their personality. Do they have personality disorder? Do they have pathological personality features? Or do they have no personality problems? Third thing is you've got to find out about their physical health. Do they have any chronic illnesses? Chronic illnesses can affect people. You can have psychiatric and neurological disturbances that can make you sound really disturbed when it's a neurological injury, right? The fourth thing is your stressors. What are your overt stressors? You know, how much stress do you have in your life? If you two are twins and you're making a nice living, you live in a wonderful affluent area, and you live in the ghetto and struggling with just paying your bills, that's going to affect your functioning and the way you cope. Lastly, how well do you function, period? How well are you doing at your job, home life, school, etc.? Those are the five axes, we call them. Defense mechanisms were slated to become the sixth. And unfortunately, American psychiatry has done away with that detailed diagnostic assessment and gotten rid of different axes. Some decent reasons for doing so, some not so decent. And, you know, that's the debate in psychiatry now. Was it a good thing? Is DSM-5 better than 4? Anyway. But defenses were really supposed to be at the center of the new developments. Why are defenses important? It's because if you predict somebody's, let's say, quality of life, overall quality of life, if you assess their level of psychiatric symptoms, symptoms will predict to some degree a person's quality of life. More symptoms, lower quality of life. If you have a personality disorder and you go to predict quality of life, it'll affect quality of life. If you put both of them in together, both of them combined to predict lower quality of life. When you add defense mechanisms in there, all three of them predict quality of life. And defenses predict something unique that is not being covered by symptoms or personality. Makes perfect sense though. Why? Because how a person copes with these things is very important.
You're right.
We have CEOs of major corporations with serious mental illnesses that are managed with medication, and they get they've got supportive environments, and they're coping well, and they can function. There are actors, actresses with bipolar illnesses, schizophrenia, you know, serious mental illnesses. As long as they can cope, as long as they can manage their illness adaptively, they can function. That's why defenses are so important, right? And defenses, you can see them clear as day in everybody. I mean, you see them, everybody uses them. It's something that everybody, so it's right in front of us all the time, right? There's a lot of talk about defense mechanisms, they don't call them that, when we look at our president,
mm-hmm.
right? He takes everything personally. He's gonna outdo everyone. He's going to get revenge on people. He speaks impulsively. He acts out constantly. It's unbelievable. Now, everybody has defenses. He's not the only one, but his fall into a particular set of defenses.
Yeah.
The minor image distorting defenses and sometimes the major image distorting defenses. These are highly pathological defenses. And depending on how often he uses them, it's going to predict a lot of things. Now, I think if you want to see the impact of those defenses, you can see people around the country who respond to him. But what I would want to talk to his wife,
yeah,
and see what life is like for her. Could you imagine?
So, oh, I try not to, yeah.
I try not to, too. Yeah. But we all have them. And so my interest has been in training students. Right now I have a series of studies going on. We're using defenses to identify women at risk for child abuse.
Mm.
It's turning out beautifully. I mean, it's interesting to see the findings. Defenses matter. We're also looking at people who've suffered child abuse, right? And they're adults now, and we look at the distress that they feel. And depending on the defenses, what we call mediate the effect of abuse on adult functioning and symptoms. Healthier defenses, better the functioning. That's why we know people who've suffered terrible abuse, some go on to develop incredible lives.
Yeah.
Very functional people do incredible things in spite of what's happened. And other people who've been abused can't function at all. And a lot of people in between too, right? So what accounts for that? Well, you know, those coping things we talked about, social support, others, probably the best, better than defenses, right? You know, good loving others in our lives is the best thing, but defenses matter. Because if you have people who love you dearly and you're using a lot of immature defenses, you can mess up those relationships and mess up your social support. And then what do you got? You ain't got much. You're left with just those conscious techniques to manage your anxiety. Well, that's fine, and they can help. Absolutely. Cognitive behavior therapy can help you develop a way of thinking that's more adaptive. Absolutely. But who cares if you don't have loved ones? Who cares if you don't have friends? I mean, right? So these defenses, I think, and maybe I'm biased, and of course I am, because I think they're the greatest thing to slice bread, right? But I'm enthusiastic about it. It's fun to study it. And I think I feel really fortunate to be able to to do what I love. I come here, I see many patients every week, a whole range of people. I teach defenses, I teach therapy techniques, but defenses are at the center. Why? Because if I see a defense, something's made them anxious. It's my job to understand it and to deliver that in a way, to deliver that message in a way that's tolerable and that people can use. And you can see people develop that way. It's nice.
So the idea of psychological defenses, that originated with Freud, right?
It originated with Freud, 1894. Okay. What was the name of the paper? Neuropsychoses of Defense.
Okay. So then how has the idea of defenses changed since then?
That's a good question. I was going to say, well, it just got more complex over time, but that's not true. Changed in a couple of ways. Freud identified certain defenses that were associated with certain personality features. Like people who are paranoid use projection all the time, right? People who are histrionic, theatrical, you know, there's all, you know, drama. He used a certain constellation of defenses. And he sort of discovered that. His daughter, Anna Freud, then went and put together this compendium of defense mechanisms and talked about how defense mechanisms develop over time. If you look at children, you see that their use of denial, the crumbs dripping from the corners of their mouths, you weren't supposed to eat that cookie, Billy. You're going to have dinner now. I didn't eat any cookie. Cookie all over. They're very common to use denial. Now, that's Billy when he was 5. But Billy at 8 would be using it less. Why? Because his mind's become more complex. So he's using more complex types of defense mechanisms. Instead of just denial, he might use projection. It's not... Amy gave it to me. My sister gave me it. She said I had to eat it. It's projection, right? So it's a little bit more complex. It's not just saying no. It's saying, oh, yeah, you got me, but it's her fault.
Yeah, no, it's a little more
complex. Yeah, right? So these defenses become more complex with development, okay? Until we get to an old fart like me who uses intellectualization a lot. I can explain things intellectually and get... You know, the more complex your nervous system, the more complex the defense use in normal people. So she was the first one, Anna Freud was the first one to describe that. Once that was described, and once everybody wrote papers on, you can't do research with psychoanalytic ideas, they're too complex, they're too special. Well, people like George Vaillant developed a coding system. I said, let's test this out. He was a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist at Harvard. And he said, I want to test this. This could be tested. We can, first, let's see if we can identify it. So he defined them. He got a group of people together and said, let's study them. And let's listen to these interviews of these people, normal people, graduates of Harvard, this longitudinal study that they had. Let's see if we can see them. And lo and behold, if we work together, we can reliably rate. I saw projection, and what did you rate? Projection? Oh, good. Unanimous. I saw denial there. Well, you saw denial, you didn't. Well, we're getting close. It's in the ballpark, right? So they would modify these coding systems until, if you look in the DSM-4, there's a coding system called the Defensive Functioning Scale. It's 33 defenses, 7 levels. That scale was put together by the defense gurus, right? You know, some people are groupies for rock bands. I'm a groupie for the defense gurus. George Vaillant, Christopher Perry, Phoebe Kramer. They all had different scales and they came together to put together this defensive functioning scale. And it was put in there because it was try it out. Because we're going to add it to the, remember I said they're going to add defenses? That scale was going to be added to the DSM system. And the next iteration of the DSM, the DSM-5, got rid of the whole detailed diagnostic system.
Right, their life's work.
Yeah, life's work. However, I keep studying it because it keeps showing some incredible things.
Yeah.
2016, we got a paper in the American Journal of Psychiatry where it had pregnant mothers describing what that infant was going to be like. We coded the defenses that they used in the interview to deal with that interview. Because, you know, asking about what do you think your child's going to be like, you draw from your own history. You can be kind of scared of what things could turn out. If you're a single mother, if you're, you know, at risk, you're not getting much money, you don't have a partner, the father's left, whatever, right? We looked at the defenses used and we looked at those children at age 2 and found that the healthier the defenses, or the opposite, the more pathological defenses, the greater the insecurity of that toddler's attachment, social emotional competence, and the greater their symptoms.
Wow.
So everybody uses all kinds of fancy psychological new ideas. What's the best thing to use to predict these kinds of things? Let's say attachment. Attachment's wonderful. Attachment predicts it. Defenses out-predict it. Defenses predict it beautifully. And also account for all of the differences in socioeconomic status, in domestic violence that's going on, a host of things, right? It adds above and beyond all these things that should affect the child's development. The defenses still do matter. And so you can't deny it. We had a study just got published of patients in cancer treatment for serious cancers, radiation treatment for serious cancers. We tested their defenses, compared them against a group of women with breast cancer survivors. You're cured now. Now, it could come back. It's a little anxiety provoking, but you should be able to, you should be fine. And then a control group. People under the greatest stress use the most immature defenses. Reason being, they blot out reality more. I mean, if I use denial right now and say, I'm not here, I don't know who you're talking to, but this isn't me, that would sound friggin' crazy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If you have cancer and you're dying, and you say, I'm not dying, anxiety is less. It's a pathological defense. Some of them can be used in moments where they're probably helpful. You can't use them throughout your life. It'll cause you a lot of trouble, right? So those undergoing cancer treatment who don't know if they're going to survive use the most intense and reality blotting out defenses.
That makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And it's helping some of them manage the worry of dying. Now, by the time the study was published, half of the sample were dead. Half of the sample were dead. These people were worrying about real stuff.
Yeah.
That's amazing, right? So these defenses, we don't even know the limits of what they can tell us about people. But we know that people use them. We know that people use them out of their awareness, their conscious awareness. And we got to figure out what these things are all about. Because if we can help people develop automatic, healthy coping mechanisms, we can keep them healthier. We can decrease healthcare costs. We can improve family lives and individual suffering. So they're just as important as anything else that you can study in the behavioral sciences, I'm convinced. Take it with a grain of salt, because I'm very biased. I love these things. You know?
Do you think it's possible for somebody to examine their own defenses, or do they need to be pointed out to them?
People who are very reflective and very open, or people who've gone through their own psychotherapy and have learned from their treatments what are the characteristic kinds of defenses, they can say, like, oh God, my initial reaction to my boss this morning, I guess it was a little bit heavy duty, and that's some, they might not think of the specific defense, but they could say, well, that was pretty defensive on my part. I just didn't feel comfortable. I was threatened, and that's why I was, I didn't answer him directly, or I didn't answer him clearly. So I got really stirred up and I was upset. So people can, yeah, people can identify it. The more self-aware someone is, chances are the greater probability that they can catch it most of the time. But some of the defenses are very, I mean, can you try to be funny? Try and be funny, do something funny. You can't really, can you? Unless you're Robin Williams and any, right, then he could have done anything. But humor is automatic. It's amazing when you see it. If you see a good comedian and they get heckled and they go right back and the whole place laughs because they got the person who was heckled, you know, that's automatic. That's not rehearsed and that's not even reflected upon. If you had to think before you told a joke, there'd be no spontaneity in the world, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be funny either.
It wouldn't be funny because that's right. That's what makes it funny. That's automatic. That's a conscious, that's a somewhat unconscious defense mechanism. We know when we're trying to be funny, but we don't know why we put it together so nicely and quickly, right? So we don't always know when it's coming and what comes out. And the healthier ones, it doesn't matter because they're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like sublimation is a healthy defense where you take your intense drives and urges and mold them into something productive. A patient I had, a 13-year-old kid who was getting in all kinds of trouble at school, mean at home, everything, got started wrestling, all of a sudden started doing his homework and was nicer to his family. These urges, these drives, these intense impulses were channeled into something productive,
yeah,
right? Okay. And so you see that, you see all kinds of different healthy defense mechanisms. Even suppression. If you're my boss and you're yelling at me, and I know you'll calm down and I know things will be okay, I can suppress what I'd like to say. Hey, right there, buddy. Right? But we're not gonna do that. We might think it, we'll suppress it. And we'll maintain it. And then after it's over, we'll think about it, we'll be fine. But suppression can be quite healthy, right? So there's all these mechanisms. If you read the list of defenses, there's all kinds of healthy ones. Even the ones that are somewhat conscious, we don't always know that we're gonna reuse them because they're automatic.
Yeah, some are more obvious than others.
Some are more obvious than others, but yeah, yeah.
So how has studying psychology influenced how you interact with others and with the world around you?
I think psychology, in addition to my own analysis, I went through when you go through psychoanalytic training, you've got to be in psychoanalysis yourself.
Oh, really?
It's 4 days a week. And I just happened I got a lot out of psychoanalysis. In fact, when I was in my postdoctoral fellowship, I got into psychoanalysis. When people are in training for psychoanalysis, I told you the five-year program, they've got to analyze three people. And so you can become what they call a control case. You can get a lower fee, charged a lower fee for your treatment if you agree to go through an analysis. When I was in my internship and postdoctoral fellowship, I went through as a control case, as a psychoanalysis, 4 days a week. I found it so helpful. I mean, I was so neurotic. I had so many worries. It was the greatest thing in the world. I loved it. I mean, sometimes it was tough because you'd talk about parts of yourself you don't like too much. But it was wonderful. It was very helpful. I think then when I started psychoanalytic training, you got to go through what they call a training analysis. You got to go to a certain analyst who specializes in doing analysis in people who are becoming analysts. So I did another six years actually, was the length of the training to get it through completely. I found it super helpful. I think that helped immensely. And then just, you know, I think getting married to the woman that I married, I think I'm very lucky. I mean, she helped me to grow and learn what it's like to be in a relationship and tolerate the tough times and talk through problems, although that's what I was training to do. And yet I didn't want to talk to her about my problems, you know. But yeah, we had to sit down and talk about it. So good analyses, two of them, a good marriage, and feeling really grateful to find work that, boy, it doesn't feel like work. I work 12, 14 hours a day. I get tired at the end of the day, but it doesn't feel like work. It feels like, and I get paid. I make a nice income, a really nice income. And they pay me for all this. I do it for nearly nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it just keeps me going.
That is awesome.
Wow. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, very lucky.
Yeah. So then our last question we always ask is, if you could go back in time to when you were, high school, undergraduate, somewhere around there, and tell yourself one thing, what would it be?
Boy, if I went back to high school and know what I know now.
You would clean up, yeah.
I'd start studying. I mean, I would think, the only thing it would do for me, I would be able to start all this stuff that I did a little earlier. It would give me a few more years of practicing this. So I'd probably say to myself, now there's a reason to do all this because I know what's on the other side. I know that I can develop a life for myself that's going to be gratifying beyond what I ever dreamed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd probably get to work. I'd probably not box. I'd probably stay in martial arts so I didn't get hit as much in the head. My short-term memory is not terrific. I had a lot of amateur fights, a lot of fights. So I'd probably cancel that out. Or maybe just do it for a year because it was fun. It was fun. But I'd probably say start studying because you can get to this sooner.
Yeah. All
right. Maybe be nicer to my parents. Maybe do
it. Yeah, outside of academics.
Because they did help me with my loans. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's all that we've got for you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for making time for us.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
A huge thank you to Dr. Porcarelli for taking time out of your busy schedule to have this conversation with us. We learned so much, and my interest has absolutely been piqued in defense mechanisms.
Yes, thank you for introducing us to this vast field of research and all of the interesting tidbits that come with it. Please check us out on Facebook, Twitter, the website. Check out the show notes for links to all of these things. Shoot us an email at hosts@pre-occupied.com. If you know a psychologist who might be a good fit for our podcast, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or if you just want to have a chat.
Absolutely. We'll see you next time on Pre-Occupied. I also picked a scab.
Oh.
I know.
Should have repressed that.
I know, I should have repressed that urge.